Now, if I and my associates knew as much about cancer as Carol Hinderly knows about Luther and the New Testament and the Bible, and as much as Rich Cameron knows about art and all those things, we'd be a lot further along. But you'll have to settle for where we are and hope we can make greater progress in the future. When one talks about cancer, one has to respect my 10th law, which states that, thank you, there is no complex problem which, if looked at in the proper way, doesn't become more complex. And this has cancer written all over it. And I thought today it might be useful to briefly review for you the extent of the problem and then look at some of the allocation, your investment into the problem, and some of the method of study of this, and then take quite a bit of time. I'm rummaging through my suitcase when Carol suggested maybe I should do something today. I found some slides from my last trip, and so I'm going to show you some of the slides from my last trip, and I won't tell you where I got it, but a little early for that, I guess. And then we're going to talk about diagnosis and treatment and some of the new methods for this, at least those in the research end of things. And then you can bring up any questions along the way if I don't make something clear to you, and that's very probable. Although it's hard for me to be very erudite because I am not equipped to do it. Now, in the discussion, we are fortunate in having, I know, at least two physicians here in the village, Doctors Pierce and Wold, and they can help on that end of things, because I'm in the research end of things. Now, what is the nature of the problem? Well, in the United States today, in a recent survey, it was shown that about two-thirds of the population feared cancer more than any other disease. It is the next to the biggest killer as far as the old people go, those over maybe 50, 55 years of age. But what makes it a very important problem for me and for my associates, and what I think drives them a great deal, is not so much that it's such an important disease of the old, but it's also a very important disease of the young. In fact, it's the biggest killer. Next to accidents of the young up to age 30 or 34. It is also the biggest killer of women from age 30 to about 55. And we haven't gotten very far with some of them. In fact, in some types of cancer, there has been a phenomenal increase. During my lifetime, even less than that, 40 years, in the last 40 years, there's been a 1,400% increase in lung cancer. And we haven't gotten very far. In fact, we haven't made no progress at all as far as mammary tumors go. But we made phenomenal progress in some of the other areas. We are going at the rate of about new cancer cases, probably one out of every four or five people are going to have some kind of tumor. Now, because when the physician closes his black bag and says, you know, you got a tumor, it isn't the end of the world. And this is one of the messages I want to be sure to get across to you today. But we thought about polio a few years ago, how awful it was. Yet in our worst year, of polio, there were about 3,500 who died. This year there will be about 350,000 who will die from cancer in the United States.
And that's rather imposing. So there's a lot of reasons to study it, not only because it cuts down so many when they're young, but also the cost of treatment is tremendous, and the loss of time on the job. We're talking here probably in the order of maybe $14 or $15 billion every year. So we have to try to do something about that. Now, what have we been doing with it up until a few years ago? We were spending at the rate of about $400 and some per capita, per taxpayer, to the Department of Defense. We were spending about $125 each up until this last year in Southeast Asia. And we were spending about $20 a year per each of us for foreign aid and for the Space Administration and Space Ventures. And we were spending 89 cents on cancer. But about the only thing that the cancer allocation per capita exceeded was our contribution to benevolence in the church. There we were only giving about a pack of cigarettes a year. So that's about the nature of your investment. Now, Nixon administration decided that they would make cancer a real issue, a conquest of cancer. Now, they likened it to the Space Administration. And I won't go into that as a wrong paradigm for this. But it isn't a good one, because cancer is far more complex than trying to get out to the moon with a few people. All you need is some, well, I won't say what you need for this. There's a physicist in the crowd. But it's an order dimension or more difference in complexity. But it's well that more money is invested in it. Now, President Nixon signed a bill allocating, I think, about $1.6 billion over the next few years for cancer, to conquest of cancer. However, in the last couple of years, the congressional appropriation was cut $90 million. And for this next fiscal year, it was cut, the congressional allocation was cut $100 million by the administration. Now, part of this may be due to the fact that a couple of former members of the White House, they're no longer there. Their names were Haldeman and Ehrlichman. They were Christian Scientists, and some people think that because, of course, in Christian Science, cancer is thought of as an illusion, that they might have had something to do with it. But the sum and substance of it, and it's a very disturbing thing to me, as my associates know, who I think are doing good work. In fact, some people regarded it as very significant, along with many other people in the United States. They, in fact, in the research, for example, in viral oncology, that is, the virus causation of cancer, have in fact realized a diminished funding in the past couple of years, and we'll realize it probably this next year. As far as the allocation of dollars for research in this field, in fact, is less. The allocation of funds is pretty much going to cancer centers. Now, I'm not knocking cancer centers. I think we need more cancer centers, and I think this is the way to go. But we shouldn't cut research. And one of the things they did, you know, is to take, well, we're going to make our swords into plowshares up here at Frederick, Maryland, at Camp Dietrich. And we're going to convert that over to some cancer, where they've been involved in biological warfare. Well, so they made a big allocation of that. Where did they get the money? They took it out of the cancer research to make sort of a support facility. And they gave it to Bionetics, a subsidiary of Litton. And I apologize to any of you who work for this firm. But you see, they're in a different situation. They go up there, and so you try to make over the facilities that are there. It would be cheaper to start from scratch. And I'm telling you what the people in National Cancer Institute tell me. And they're able to take people from the National Cancer Institute up there to diminish their forces because they can pay them more, technicians and others. So they deplete their rank. And they really haven't, you know, they're going to be a long time coming out with anything where I maintain, and the overhead is far higher. They're far better off giving the money to institutes throughout the country and universities who are equipped and going, rather than to go to some what appears to be just a political boondoggle to some of us. So I'm telling you that the amount of money you're putting in cancer research in many areas is really less than it was, in spite of what you read in the papers. I believe that this is unfortunate. Now, on the methods of study, I believe in the concept of one medicine, and I have spent much of my life in comparative medicine. And to give you some instances of this, much of what we have learned about you people, as far as disease and everything goes, we have learned from animals, although we haven't always picked it up rapidly. For example, on, say, the whole bacterial theory of disease, back in about 1850, a fellow in France and Pollender in Germany discovered that the anthrax bacillus in sheep. Yet I guess it was 30 years before they really accepted the germ theory and applied it to people. That was 30 years long. Or in about the turn of the century, we knew that pleuropneumonia in cattle was caused by mycoplasma. Yet this was not accepted or discovered that mycoplasma also causes pneumonia in people until 1950. That's 50 years. Or a lot of people bring up the case of Jenner. Now, whenever you mention Jenner, a lot of people say, well, that dirty old man chased milkmaids in England. Well, the truth of the matter is Jenner was a very competent comparative, a worker in comparative medicine, and very careful techniques on many species of animals, developed the whole principle of vaccination. Yet it was 80 years before this was taken up. In the case of Pasteur, I mean, he's the really one who got it going. But 80 years before, it was already proof of principle. I could go into many other examples of this. I think we learn from history that we do not learn from history. But I hope that isn't true and that we will apply these things faster and make use of this information. In the case of cancer, for example, now, I guess it was early in this century when Peyton Rouse at Rockefeller showed that he could take cell-free extract from a sarcoma in the chicken and transfer this disease and cause this disease in another chicken, thus saying that viruses may have something to do with cancer. But they said that's chickens. And in research, chicken workers are sort of looked down on in many ways. And that's unfortunate, really, because we've learned a lot from them. And you remind me to mention the vaccination program that's underway in chicken at the end. But there's been some remarkable developments there. Well, on this thing of comparative medicine and modeling, there are probably at least 250 diseases of people in which we have an animal counterpart. And you see, there's many things that you cannot study in people. You only study it after the fact, after the disease develops. In order to understand the disease, you really need to study it as it develops. And you do not have that option in people, although some workers have done this. But we are reaching, I think, the end of the kamikaze human guinea pig, of watching black people with syphilis die from it rather than treating them. People are taking exception to this now, fortunately. There will be more and more legislation preventing human experimentation. They're going to reduce the amount being done in prisons. The conscientious objector program is being reduced because the draft is over with, so this is going to be reduced, so we have to go to animals, you see. And I'm going to give you some examples of of some of the animals that we propose using in research or that we are already using in research. Now, coming back to this whole bio-oncology thing, some of us feel that viruses do have something to do with cancer. Well, it's a very complex problem, and this will become evident to you now as we go through it. Now, this is a very complex field, and I'm just going to give you sort of one peek, sort of one glimpse of one perhaps small area in this whole cancer field, but an exciting one. I've spent most of my life studying the effects of radiation. Of course, one of the effects of radiation, in high levels at least, is the induction of cancer. And also it gives us, it induces some diseases that are models for people. I mentioned that we have probably 250 diseases in animals, that are in people that have a animal counterpart, but there are some very important diseases in people for which we have no animal counterpart or that we've found. I'm sure they're probably there, but we just haven't found them. We've flushed them down, sort of thing, without realizing it, because although I have been proposing that more veterinarians learn human diseases and more human physicians or human research workers and human medicine learn the animal diseases, we're moving that direction, but we have more to do on it because we have to get together on this, realizing that there is, in truth, a one medicine. So with that now, I'm going through some of our life with animals. And one of the things we did, and I'm going to turn off these lights. And this is just to remind me that one of the things we have induced in radiation is a myelogenous leukemia, and we don't have a good model for this for this disease in people in animals. Although probably the one we induced in the dog with radiostrontium, we had some of these dogs appear with a myelogenous leukemia, and it is quite similar to that in people. And it has been, I think, so accepted. And this has, in fact, then you can take this disease and you can transplant it in utero. That is, you go into the pup before birth and inject the material, and it will induce the disease in the pup. And that's how you prove whether this is, in fact, a cancer. Now, we haven't found an agent in this yet. We are suspicious of one, but these are the kinds of studies you do. Now, you couldn't do this, of course, in adults, because it is probably well, even at this point in the lecture, to tell you that cancer has, or the immune system has quite a bit to do with cancer, where in the very young or in utero, in pregnancy, the immune system isn't developed, so you can make the individual tolerant to certain things or accept certain things which it would reject later in life, or early in life, really, as its immune system is developed. Now, our whole expedition into the viral oncology at the University of California, that is, virus causation of tumors, started in cattle. There are certain clusters throughout the world of leukemia in cattle. They are what we call high incidence herds, and many people were concerned about this. They said, well, maybe what's happening here is that, like in the mouse, the cattle with leukemia might secrete virus in the milk, and that's drunk by little children, who then may show leukemia. And so there were quite a few projects initiated to study this and to try to transmit the disease by cell-free extracts from cattle with bovine leukemia, or leukemia cattle, into calves. And it was during this time that my associate, who Carol mentioned yesterday, a Japanese named Kawakami, who's an outstanding worker, he said, you know, while we're working on this cattle thing, and it's so long, and this is very difficult work when you're dealing with large animals because the latency is so long. You have to wait so long. You can't do something today and report it tomorrow. And he was interested in leukemia on cats. And he was the first one in the United States to find a leukemia virus in cats. And he showed the virus, and then he induced the disease in young kittens. And about that time, a graduate student associated with us named Stan Snyder, he found a fibrosarcoma virus in cats. And he was the first one in the world to show this feline sarcoma virus. And you can take this virus and put it into newborn kittens and produce the disease within a matter of weeks, and it will kill the cat. And then they took this virus and they put it in marmosets. And I'll show you a picture of a marmoset in a little while. It's a small South American primate. It's one of the tamarins. They're very small. They're usually born as twins. And I've shown some of you pictures of these before. But it did induce a tumor in a non-human primate. So the people became very excited about this. The National Cancer Institute workers were very excited about it. And it has been a very useful tool to study. And then, let me see what's the next. Yes, let me take this in first. And what Kawakami did here was to take this virus, and he went to a newborn calf, and he took out the thymus out of this calf, and he grew the thymus, and he put the virus from the cat into the thymus from the calf, and it grew, and then he went back into this same calf. So he wouldn't have a complex situation. There would be no other animals or anything involved in here. So he hyperimmunized the calf then, so he had then a very specific test serum. And one of the things we did with it then was to show what this extract does. And if you look up, we put virus in there. Well, we put virus here and virus here, and you see that the tumor is growing very rapidly. And up in here, this was some adjuvant or something. Oh, this was a different dilution. But over here, we put the virus with this sera from this calf. And of course, there's no growth at all. And this gave us a hint. And then I'll come back to this, so you'll be sure to remind me of what we've done with that now, although we're in very preliminary stages with it. But this sort of started the ball rolling. Well, and then what happened was a rather exciting thing. A pet woolly monkey was ailing, and it was brought to the clinic at the University of California, Davis. Murray Fowler said, boy, that looks like a tumor to me. So he called in the pathologist and the clinical oncologist, Gordon Thielen, and whose son, incidentally, has been to Holden, and also another associate, and they said, certainly it is fibrosarcoma. And Tom Kawakami was successful in culturing this material and obtained a virus from it. And then they took this virus and induced tumors in another primate. And of course, this was very exciting, because up to this point, people said, well, sure, viruses, we admit, cause tumors in chickens, and so what? And it causes it in mice, but they're very special things. They're highly inbred. And now, of course, it's in cats, but maybe cats are different. But now it's getting closer to home, sort of thing. It's in the primates. At least it's getting close to Norwegians. And that's when I became very interested. And of course, up to this point, I had many years ago asked a lot of people. I said, what about tumors in primates? I talked to a lot of people who had primates. And we don't see very many. Well, I couldn't believe it. And since that time, of course, if you see primates around long enough, you're going to see tumors. And so I put the scouts out to all over the world, really, because I was interested in collecting up non-human primate tumors. And there we had one right in our backyard, and that was very exciting. And it did induce then. Here's a little marmoset. You see how small it is? It's a little tiny thing. And they're kind of immunologically crazy. And they're also hard to get along with. They're little tigers, but they did show tumors. And we did some cooperative work with Presbyterian St. Luke's in Chicago, and they helped us on this. And then a very exciting thing happened. One day, we got a call from the University of California, San Francisco, And there was a veterinarian down there, and he said, "Say, that looks like a tumor on that gibbon. I introduce you to one of the remarkable specimens, some of my most remarkable friends, and they're gibbon apes. They're Hylobates lair, or the white-handed gibbon. And they had some white-handed gibbons. Dr. Malcolm Jones down there was studying the development of the skeleton of the gibbon. The gibbon is an ape. It's one of, according to some people, some of our more closer relatives, they're in a family of the orangutan and the chimp. Yeah, and they're the smallest ones. And when you're dealing with these characters, you're dealing with somebody that you question, well, who should be inside the pen and who should be outside the pen. And they are very much like us in many ways, and their whole family setup of the gibbon is probably most like ours. And you have to respect them. Well, they were studying the skeletal development, and they had this tumor, so we did an evening post-mortem on it because it was in extremis, that is, it was going to die. And Dr. Kalkani was successful in finding viral particles in this tumor, which is, of course, very exciting. And he had, in the meantime, made an anti-serum to this gibbon ape virus, the same way as he did the cat. So he had a very specific test serum for it. And it turned out that the virus in this gibbon had a very close relation to the virus in the woolly monkey, but not to the cat or anybody else. This, of course, also was very exciting. And then we told San Francisco about finding this, and we described the tumor, and they said, well, that sounds just like the first one that died. So that was 2 out of about 6. Well, we had some friends down in Southeast Asia, the Keto Lab, where the largest gibbon colony in the world was housed, studying malaria and dengue fever and other things in an army laboratory down near Bangkok. And a fellow named Dennis Johnson, a veterinarian down there, had described some tumors in there in the late 60s. And another veterinarian was down there from our laboratory, who had gone to our laboratory, Alex DiPoli, and a physician named Dr. Mill. And they said, boy, we're seeing quite a few tumors here. And in that colony, like the colony in Georgia, Boris Lapin's colony in southern Russia, and our own primate colony at the University of California, Davis, and San Francisco thing to an extent, they all had a kind of a similar history. At least 3 of them. They had human material inoculated into them. At least 2 of the colonies had malaria, or had studied in malaria. And they had all had a herpes infection of some sort. And now herpes are your cold sores and related things. Now we have come to realize, of course, herpes kinds of viruses are responsible for some tumors. And if I have time, we'll go into this. But back to this story on the gibbon, which is one we're still pursuing. And we've tested out now some colonies, and we find that in these colonies in which the tumor has appeared, they are some positive reactors to our test serum down at CETO and at San Francisco Medical Center, but not in the Hylobates lair, in the white-handed gibbon, in the zoo there, or in a drug firm that has some gibbons back east. So this is very interesting to us. And now we're checking, you see, we're getting human tumors to see, is there a relationship here? And we're looking at the placenta of people, of women, and to check them to see if we do see these particles. We see, and other people have seen particles in the placenta of monkeys and also in people, and we don't know the significance of these yet. Now, Doc, I wanted to have you see an outstanding research worker, Dr. Kawakami, who works night and day at this kind of business, and he's pointing us to a C-type virus particle under the electron microscope. And and here we see one of our gibbons, who's a great guy. His name is Judas. The reason I call him Judas is that we obtained him from the San Francisco Zoo. My associates went down to get him, and you know, they were all upset for him, because these fellows, when they get a little older, they're kind of hard to get along with, and they got some big canines, and they're quicker than cats. And Boyd Harrell on the right, he's an outstanding Gibbon man, was all ready for him. And the caretaker went on in, because it was a 10-year-old, and you get a 10-year-old Gibbon, you know he's been around. He knows all the tricks. So they were kind of apprehensive of this, and so the caretaker, he says, "Well, where do you want him?" "No." He says, "I'll go and get him." And so they were all, you know, for him, and pretty soon he came tearing out with old Judas, and Judas had his arms around the caretaker, and it was kind of a cheerful party, because he was a real pet. The reason we got him is that he had a little, he had a lesion on him that had healed up. He had gotten torn or something, and he had a scar there. And of course, if you're showing a Gibbon, people will keep calling you up and saying, "Hey, there's something wrong with that Gibbon." So they wear you out. So you couldn't show him. So we ended up with Judas. Now, the reason I call him Judas is that we have other Hylobates, other Gibbons, that are not, they haven't been pet. So they're a bit hard to get along with. And they pair off. And you have to work with pairs. And our object is to get some little ones. And so you have to pair them off for this. I'll tell you how that works sometime. But, you know. But anyway, and if you go on and bother the missus, the father is right there to give you a bad tongue. So you have to really watch him. And to try to get him, to get a blood sample out of him, they even know when you got a syringe in your pocket and it isn't even sure. Now, I guess there's something about you when you walk in that room, boy, they say, "Boy, it's blood time today, you know." Boy, it takes quite a bit to get them, even though you might weigh 170 pounds and maybe they only weigh 15. But we found out that if you go in and take Judas, and you go in there and lead him by the hand, and he comes out there, and you walk into the pen where Mr. and Mrs. Gibbon are, and they get all excited, you see, and they come tearing down to the fence and reach through to grab old Judas. And so you grab this, and there you got your arms and make the blood. That's why we call him Judas. Now, I'm going to tell you a little more about these, because I want you to have respect for animals. He got out one day and went playing with a goat. We had a little trouble with that. But we finally, Boyd went out there and told him it was time to come in, so he did come in. There's a friend of ours who has been out in the Southeast Asia studying gibbons in the wild. And he gave a presentation to us, and he had some sounds from various species of primates, including Hylobates lair, the white-headed gibbon. And he played some of these sounds for us. And I said, "I want you to take those sounds out to our gibbons and play." So he played some of the sounds from the other languages. And then he got to the Hylobates lair, you know? And you should have seen it. I mean, they were wild. The father, he was really shook up. I don't know what they were saying, but he was really shook up. I think it was some given love call, because the female became very interested. And the male, he grabbed the perch and he went around so fast you could hardly see him, and he stomped like this, and he understood the language. Well, both of them did. And speaking of their language, and it's a very interesting thing, because, and I was going to bring a tape, and I didn't, because I didn't think I'd be able to stand up when I got here, and I forgot the tape, and I'd play it for you. Some very beautiful singing, and they have a remarkable vocalization. And we had a lady who had a couple of gibbons, pets, and she was going around the country talking about these wonderful gibbons. And she came to see our gibbons. She was the wife, I think, of some State Department employee or something in Thailand. Now, she didn't know that our Mrs. Gibbon had a little one, and that she had lost her little one. And she came in there, and she listened, and she said, "Mrs. Gibbon is very sad." She says, "I can tell by her song." She was singing a very mournful song, probably of the loss of her little one. Now, the epitome, I think, of their intuitiveness is manifested by a story that Alex DePauli and Dennis Johnson told me down at People Land. Now, they're very suspicious of women, these fellows. And they were having a tour in the CETO lab, and the executive officer had a prepared speech. He had it in his pocket here. And he, before he started the tour of these women nurses and technicians, he said, "Now, we're going out to the Gibbons, and I don't want you to get near their cage, because one of these fellows reaching through that kind of screen we have there, they can reach through before you see it, and they got long arms. And before you know it, they've gotten something from you. Like your glasses, they'll pick your glasses and give them a heave or nick you or something." Well, so he told about this. Well, one nurse either didn't hear or she didn't believe it. And as she was walking along, she got up pretty close. You know what happened. Well, so grabbed her, and before she got completely topless, the executive officer extricated the gibbet. And gallant man that he was. But with the other hand, you see, he grabbed the gibbon's hand here, but with the other hand, the gibbon reached down. I don't know if he flicked off his glasses, but he pulled out his speech out of his top pocket. He retreated to the center perch. He opened up the speech and looked it over and proceeded to tear it up. And here's a picture. As you see, the Gibbon here is reading his own creation, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon. That's the ultimate. So, now, I guess I was going to show that later. But, I want to talk a little bit about a couple other things. But the point here is that, and what we are working on, what some of our associates in many places throughout the country are working on, you know, is there what similarity is there in this? And we do, many places are seeing and suspicious of some similarity. Viruses probably are involved in somewhere in the causation, at least, of some tumors. A combination of things where you have some damage where it causes proliferation, that is multiplication of cells. You can't have cancer without multiplication of cells. But if you have this multiplication of cells, and if you have certain chemicals might release certain things, along with a virus may be released, or hormones may do this. But you have to get some information into the genetic mechanism. And that's what viruses can do. And so we feel that they do have something to do with it. In the diagnosis, there have been some remarkable achievements in recent times. We now are, for example, this Tessera. We can tell, for example, using this Tessera about the possibility of whether a cat has a feline leukemia or sarcoma by how it responds to this. And we have gone on, for example, in our radiobiology lab in nuclear medicine, in working with certain agents in cooperation with other people, we have methods, for example, where we can see bone tumors long before you see it by x-ray, by using certain radioactive elements using certain instruments like the Anger camera. We can see these tumors before you are able to see them by conventional x-ray. Or in your hip, for example, in your hip joint, where you have a common fracture of femur head, for example, like the chief head. And we were sweating that out, the blood supply coming back to it. Well, under these techniques, we could tell much earlier. So there are many techniques developing for early diagnosis. Some of them we aren't using, like the Pap test, and the physicians may want to say more about that. I suppose there are, you know, where this is available to everyone, probably the women in America, less than half of them are taking advantage of these during the age in which they are most susceptible to cervical carcinoma. But we are making progress in this area by various test methods. Now, as far as treatment goes, well, prevention. Now, we had a disease we call Merrick's disease, which has caused a great deal of money in the poultry industry. It's a tumor that affects the poultry and wipes out a lot of them. It's caused not by an RNA virus, we call an RNA virus the type of virus that I've been talking about here, but it's called a DNA virus, like herpes, mononucleosis, and Burkitt's lymphoma, and this type of thing. Well, this Merrick's disease, of course, had a big problem at hand. A fellow named Churchill, I think, in Hobbs in England, developed a vaccine by this virus out of a turkey. And they grew this out and they vaccinated, and of course saved a lot of chickens this way by vaccine. They say, well, maybe this vaccination has some potential. And the fellow, Epstein, of Epstein-Barr virus, which is the cause, well, it's implicated in the causation of Burkitt's lymphoma. You see these little black children in Africa where their face gets all swollen up. It's kind of a leukemia type thing. Lymphoid tissue in their eyes come out. And it's really a terrible thing. We don't have it in this country, although the same virus in this country causes mononucleosis, or at least they're positive on the therapeutic. But Epstein is proposed maybe they can make a vaccine for it, although this disease is treatable by other means now. So they may not go to it, but this gave us encouragement. Now, in our case of our cats, and we haven't published this yet, but because we're trying to assemble more data, but what we did was to give a virus to some kittens, feline sarcomavirus. Then we put some other stuff with it, like some adjuvant, Coyne's adjuvant or something. And then we give and then we treated the virus certain ways with our test serum. We modified the virus, but it was still alive. And we gave that to some of the kittens. Now, all of the kittens that had all the other treatments died. The only ones that were still alive after 10 months were the ones with this vaccination. And we had challenged them with enough virus so that they should be dead in a matter of weeks. And so this is very exciting. Now, on therapy. There have been great advances made in therapy in recent times. Leukemia of children is still a very bad disease. Yet there are some rather remarkable advances made in therapy for these. I think last time I was here, I told you about Don Pinkel's work and his associates at St. Jude in Tennessee, where they developed a system where they get the child early, they get him in remission with chemotherapeutic regime, that is various multiple, where they're using multiple chemicals to get a remission of the disease. And then they irradiate the head and neck with up to 2,500 R, which is a very large dose, over a period of a couple of weeks. And now I don't know what the long-term effects of this will be, but they have far in excess of 50%, I think, survival beyond 5 years. You know, in the old regime, maybe 5%. And with chemotherapy, they realized some rather remarkable things. Over in Seattle, E. Donnell Thomas and his group, and I don't know if I'd go this route, but it really works with certain children, like with a twin. Of course, the chance identical twins getting tumors is very high. If one identical twin gets a tumor, there's a very high probability that the other twin will also give. But if you have identical twins, and one of them gets a tumor, and he is done, he takes the child with the tumor, and then he irradiates that child with 1,000 R, which would kill the child without therapy, but because it wipes out the bone marrow. But then he takes the bone marrow from the other child, inoculates it into the radiant child and establishes then a new bone marrow. And he has some who would have been dead, because he was only doing it for those that were far gone and there's no other kin. And he has some now that are surviving on beyond a year or two. And in fact, I saw one of them. It was a brother-sister kind of thing. This little boy had his sister's bone marrow. What is important here is that you match it. Because if I take my bone marrow and give it to you, you'd reject it. Or if you irradiated you and you accepted it, my cells would reject your cells and you'd have a very bad disease from which you'd die. Yes?
They weren't identical
twins? No, not the ones. You see what they did though? They pardon?
How did match them now?
Yeah, what he does, he runs some tests to see the extent of the similarity. In fact, if you have about five brothers and sisters, there are some that will be closer matched to you than others. And with radiation and with some immunosuppressants, that is, some drugs that will suppress the immune reaction, he has had them survive. This little boy I saw was a year and a half beyond, and he's 12-year-old. He's a little smaller than his sister, who was younger. But he was just lively as all get out, going to school and living normal life. And he would have ordinarily been dead for at least a year. So there are advances, but I don't think this is a full solution. Now, one of the things that's really exciting right now, and I don't know to what extent it'll have application, but it's called the transfer factor. And it really challenges our whole concept of immunology. By way of explanation, I'll go back to the work of Koch in 1890. And in which we found out that tuberculosis, if you have a case of tuberculosis, your cells are so modified, your white cells, so that if I come back to you after some months and I inject a little bit of tuberculin, some of the bacillus of the tubercle, you will react rather remarkably. And that's the basis for the test for tuberculosis that I was exposed to in later life. Now, if they were very interested in delayed hypersensitivity, and just what caused it? Well, if I were positive for tuberculosis, that is, if I had it, and Gene Swire wasn't, they found out that if they just took my white cells and injected them into G, she would then be positive. She'd be a skin test positive, where she used to be a skin test negative. And then Lawrence in New York, in about 1955, she left the cells out and they light. And he didn't know this, so he went on with it sooner. Like inside, let's face it, a lot of the advances are made by mistakes, but they're at least smart enough to see that a mistake was made, and some of them are even honest enough to admit it. But what happened was that he came in the next day and said, you know, I left those cells all night, and they light, so, you know, but it worked. So there was something then inside this cell, which they call the transfer factor, so that they can just take some of the juice from the white cell and transfer. Now, we've known this now quite a while. And it defies everything because it's non-antigenic, this material. It doesn't cause a reaction. It is very small, and it's dialyzable. It can go through a very fine material. And it just doesn't obey things, the rules like it should. And this is what makes it so exciting. But what it's been used for example, in Wiskott-Aldrich's syndrome, which is an immune disease in children, where they show up with high incidence of disease, they're lacking, I think, in platelets and a bunch of other stuff, and it's just a bad scene. Well, in the San Francisco Medical Center, People have been using it and have been treating Wiskott Aldrich syndrome with it. It's used in coccidioidomycosis. I think they're now starting to use it in leprosy, and it is being tested also in tumors. But our problems are that we do not have an animal model for it. It's only showing in people. Well, I think that we can show it in a gibbon, and one of my associates, Mustafa Friend, is very hot on this, and it appears that he may, at least he's shown it, I think, for coccidioidomycosis to an extent in the dog. So, but we haven't got an in vitro test for it. That is, we don't have a laboratory test without animal for it. And so we're working very hard on that, as are many other people. And so possibly, you know, a combination of things, maybe with his transfer factor, maybe with immunotherapy, a combination with chemotherapy, maybe we can get to this, and maybe in some cases vaccination. So are there many things, you know? It's very exciting. It's very difficult for me to leave our laboratory in California to move to the state of Washington, because it's a jumping place. It's sort of night and day. You know, the first thing I'll do when I get off the boat is to get on the pole. What happened now, you know? It's weekends and everything. And so it's exceedingly exciting. Now, I should mention something about BCG, because it has been mentioned before, and this is part of the immunotherapy field. A friend of mine named Edmund Klein, who has treated quite a few people, and he has used BCG, which made headlines here some months ago, when it says, Oak Ridge scientists have cure for cancer. And got everybody's hopes up, and it was ridiculous. Well, because they've worked in animals and they're also, well, people have been using, studying BCG for a long time. The Bacillus of Calmette and Gironde, it's a form of tuberculosis, the causative tuberculosis, that they've made into a vaccine for which they vaccinate people in Europe. And they have been for a long time. Now, what you're trying to do in some cases of cancer is to try to build up their cellular, what we call their cellular immunity, so they will reject the tumor. And what Edmund Klein has done with is on certain superficial tumors especially, skin tumors, he has taken this BCG and hyperimmunized them. Boy, it really looks awful. Cover their whole back with this stuff and some other chemicals, and it's all red, and it must be awful. But he's had some remarkable remissions. In fact, I saw one case, this woman, they were going to quarter her because she was all involved over this whole shoulder. And they were going to take off her shoulder and her arm, and they were going to take off her right breast so they'd have enough skin to cover what they took off. But before they did that, he gave her the full treatment. Boy, you know, the back is all red and it's awful. And then some months later, he saw the picture of the, essentially he was all healed up. And you know, it almost makes a believer. So for certain conditions where you can stimulate this cellular immunity, it may, in a few isolated cases, do something. There are some questions, and then perhaps the physicians will want to say something about, you know, getting your pap test and cutting down your smoking. And yes?
You said that the mononucleosis,
yes,
virus is the same as that virus in Africa.
Yeah. At least, if I take the serum from a child in Africa with Burkitt's, and somebody in this country, their serum with that have mononucleosis, they respond similarly to the test serum. In other words, indicating that the same virus is involved. That's right.
I was wondering if like the vaccines we're giving nowadays are attenuated viruses?
Yes, there's various forms of it. Some are killed viruses. In certain areas, for example, for animals, you can't use live virus. In other cases, you are using attenuated, modified viruses. Now, that's also a problem, because I think we'll run into it. What you have to realize is that viruses change. You know?
That's my
That's a very important thing to realize. For example, you can take this whole thing of influenza. Now, we don't know for sure whether the big 1918 flu epidemic came from pigs or whether we gave it to pigs. And then a later one, whether we gave it to the horse or the horse gave it to us. But we know one thing, that the animal influenzas and the human influenzas sort of get together, and they roll in the hay together, as it were, and they come up with something else. And it isn't like the other, it's antigenically different. And that's why you keep getting all these, you know, you get a new round of them every few years, don't you? Because the virus has changed. And that's true, I mentioned in Merrick's disease, and the vaccination for Merrick's disease that's been developed. Are they using this thing from the turkey? Well, it's probably changing, or the animals are changing, so you're probably going to have to come up with another one. Yeah. Well, no. Well, I have more than a passing interest in slow virus. Slow viruses are one of the things of the future. In research, when we get further along on cancer, for some of the cancers may be due to slow viruses. Slow viruses are a very difficult thing to work with. I had a talk with Dave about it just yesterday. Slow viruses don't obey many of the rules of viruses. They take a long time to appear, maybe in many cases decades. One of the groups that's been studied the most are related. It's a guy named Sigurdsson Eysland started a lot of this stuff and set up sort of the principles for it, because they had some diseases in sheep there, Visna and some others. But the scrapie is a disease of sheep. It's a nervous disorder. A lot of these are nervous disorders or really terrible, and it's a one-way trip. Yeah, it's an encephalopathies. And the group I'm talking about, for example, are the subacute spondylosis encephalopathy. I think they're SAE, yeah. It's Kuru, which was in some of the South Pacific people who, by their religious practices, would eat the liver of their compatriots. And some of them would end up dying with Kuru, which is a tough way to go. And then we have this disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. I'm not too sure if that isn't what Ken Knudsen died from, you see. And it's a one-way trip. Things just sort of get worse, and pretty soon your functional neurons are gone. And it's a tough way to go, and it's a long talk. The disease that's studied most is scrape in sheep, where they go around and itching, and of course you can't tell on a sheep so much whether it's losing its IQ, because it didn't have much to start with. Its IQ is below detection to begin with. And then we have another disease, which is mink encephalopathy. And these four diseases are quite similar. In fact, what's strange about them is that you can't see them on the electron microscope. You can put the material that you can transmit the disease from, you can put it in formula, still works. You can heat it, and it still works. You can put it under ultraviolet light, and it still works. You can't see it, and there's no in vitro test for it. So you know, you've got it's stacked against you. And then you've got to wait for years for it to appear in many cases. So there's a whole herd of others. I don't know, maybe multiple sclerosis if you still hear it. These often, and at Washington State University, it's an exciting thing here, they're very strong in comparative medicine, and they are studying some of these diseases of the slow virus. So equine infectious anemia is a slow virus that affects horses. And many we don't know about. And they are not then DNA or RNA, you know, the coding there. Maybe they're part of the membrane, but you can transmit. In fact, those four diseases that I just mentioned have been transmitted, all four of them, caused the disease in France. So it's sort of the next one of the next big thoughts as we look ahead in medical research. And what I told a group in Philadelphia just last Wednesday, that the chronic degenerative diseases, the slow viruses, arthritis, and all these things, and aging, I said, boy, you better get at it, because it's going to
I'm getting there. Point taken. You know, get to work. Yes. Yes. The question that's raised is a very important one, and I've neglected it. Are the potential carcinogens in food? We're getting more every day. I mean, we're not able to test them all. I suppose there's thousands of them. And many of them are proven carcinogenic to animals. And maybe they are to people. I suppose 8 out of 10 cancers are caused maybe from extraneous things. And if they're not the only agent that caused it. And I should point out this, that when I went to school early, you know, it was a very simple kind of a thing. This particular bacteria would cause this disease. A simple kind of a thing. Well, it ain't quite that way. It's just like my friend who used to be provost at the University of Florida, in the medical school there. He was an immunologist. You know, and his son would get a cold and he'd bring him in and say, what's the matter, you know? What's bothering you, see? You know, the psyche is wrapped up in it, and who's giving you a bad time? It's tied up in your body chemistry. It's your immunology is wound up in it. The hormone balance is probably involved in it, and who's chewing on you? And we have to say that the virus and bacteria also might have something to do with it, or these chemicals. But it's a very complex thing. But there are chemical agents that we take every day that are carcinogenic, especially taken in large amounts. On the other hand, I think most of us can get through life taking low levels of some of these. I mean, every time you take a carcinogen, if you take very low amounts of it, there's no sign you're going to get it. You understand what I mean? And for example, this whole cyclamate bit, it kind of keyed me off, really. I'm not so sure that it probably didn't do more damage than good by pulling cyclamates off. What is it based on? Well, unfortunately, we have a law, and I can see some advantage to it, but there's a lot of disadvantages. The Delaney Amendment that says, you know, if you can show that it causes tumors in anything, it's no go. Yet I can name some things that are necessary for you. For example, selenium. Some people say, well, selenium can cause tumors. You know, what are you going to do? It's a required element for you, and it causes tumors. Well, like my old friend Hans Enon says, Ritson, you know, we'll never get out of this thing alive. But on the case of cyclamate, what are some of the proof of it? They put it in a capsule, the material, in beeswax or something, and put it on the bladder of a rat. And I can cause a tumor in a rat with almost anything. And so they put enough in there, maybe they're going to get an effect. And the equivalent of it would be, you would probably see some effect with cyclamate if you drank 800 bottles a day. Maybe it's only 600, but I don't know. You see, they get carried away on this. But there are chemical carcinogens, and we haven't tested them all, and taken in large quantities at least, they will do it, and also we have to respect the fact that there's a lot of variation in the population. Or maybe there are two populations. Some who by their body chemistry, their immunology, and all these other things are very sensitive. And they kind of pick up everything. And some others of us who are very tough. Or by genetics. You know, some of you, you know, are tougher than others and would resist it. We know that there are familial tendencies. There are high-incidence families and low-incidence families of a lot of things. In my family, there's a lot of crazy people. Nuts! We've had stomach trouble. Yeah, and that was the vaccination. Yeah. I'm going to tell about that.
It had to do with that strange-looking white thing that crawled out on all fours.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was a vaccination of the cat. Yeah, yeah. That it looks promising.
Very selfish question. What exactly are the
juveniles? Well, you see various statistics on this, and there again, you have to respect what I call the dose effect curve, the number of tumors you might see is related to the dose you take. And if you take a very high dose, you'll have a better chance for a high incidence. And that's true with smoking. If you're smoking two or three packs a day and have for a long time, I guess your chances of getting a tumor are about, if you play Russian roulette and had an 8-chamber gun or 9-chamber gun, it's about probably 1 out of 8 or 9. Of manifesting some form of tumor. But it isn't that simple because your chances, I mean, there are other things that have a higher incidence. The chances of having, you'll have a higher incidence of oral tumors, you'll have a higher chances of stomach trouble, and worse than that is the emphysema. You have much higher incidence of emphysema. I mean, if you beat the weed to that extent, chances are by the time you're 50, 55, or the physician would say, your chance of emphysema, I mean, I'd like to play with those odds. I mean, you'd really win on it, because you'd really, but the other thing is heart trouble. Much, much higher incidence of heart trouble. The incidence would be higher than that of carcinoma. But with less, and so on, it depends on people. A lot of people can go through life smoking too fast today. And other than, not tasting their food very well, and, causing a lot of distress to the people around them. And maybe causing some tumors and distress in the people around them, they might live out a fairly long life. and I know it. I mean, it's a tough thing. Some of my best friends smoke. And I really feel sorry for them. And some of the most intelligent people. I mean, two of my closest associates. In fact, they're both Jews. As long as I think about it. But they, they're really intelligent. And we've discussed it, it's one of the worst addictions there is, really. It's really tough. And I feel for these people. And I tell you this because if there are some youth here who, are considering smoking, you're just got to have your head examined, to even start. It's just not the thing to get into. But once you get into it, there are some people that just will never be able to break. Well, I won't say that. I think it's possible. But for some, it is exceedingly difficult. And it's bad news. And you're costing the taxpayers just a hell of a lot of money. And yourself.
What are the effects then of non-smokers being continually exposed to the cigarette?
Yeah, it depends there again on the concentration. And some of our people are very sensitive. I know a case, in fact, here in Canada, where the child manifested an unusual allergy symptomatology. It was, in retrospect, it was due to his father smoking. He never smoked. So, and I don't think the nature of this has really been shown, except we know it's very bad. And some people, they get headaches, and how do you measure this? It's bad news. Now, on aging, if you look at the statistics on lifespan, 2 packs a day will shorten the lifespan, I imagine, right around 10 to 12 years. One pack, maybe around 6, 3 packs, then probably 5. Of course, it depends a lot also on the type of cigarette. Of course, there's a lot of activity trying to improve the cigarette that comes in. But that doesn't help the person that's out there. They almost need a face mask, God. But a dog may be helpful person that's in here. About herpes? Yes. I got a lot of respect for herpes. And it's these cold sore kind of things and related things. They are incriminated in cervical carcinoma and in several other tumors of people right now. I believe that they have contributed, for example, herpes hominis and simplex too probably, they have, I think, contributed to the higher incidence of tumors in the primate colonies that I told you about. That you have then these viruses causing some damage to the person or to these monkeys that had to be repaired, and even might have contributed some information from the into the DNA. I mean, I'm not ruling that out. I also have respect for it because we have some diseases, herpes diseases, for example, Bivar. I think it's herpes, in monkeys. And boy, it's bad news. There's one disease in monkeys from a herpes that now I know, I think, what is it, 18 people have got it. 17 of them are dead, and the 18th one, they wish he were dead. I mean, he's not with us because some of them end up with encephalopathy. Well, your cold sore thing can invade sometimes your central nervous system. She, for example, had a herpes into her brachial plexus here. It was miserable. And some of them, I was talking to a physician very recently, who worked on these, and he's quite sure he was a lot, even your simple cold sore sometimes maybe it's a transient, maybe fever, and sometimes it's may, for related herpes, end up as sort of mild infections involved in the brain. More and more you'll have it. Yes. Those of you who have to go, is this time for the coffee break? Coffee break. Go on, and I'll be available here for a little while.